today. Join me on facebook.com/stage, the letter N studio, or tweet me at stage, the letter N studio. Till next time, I'm Dimay Roberts.
Ballot Measure 57, Oregon's mandatory minimum sentencing law for nonviolent property crimes, accounts for nearly half the women serving prison time in Oregon. And as Oregon legislators consider opening a second women's prison, a new report, Unlocking Measure 57, explains how the development of Oregon criminal laws over the last few decades has widened the net of defendants receiving mandatory minimum sentences for property offenses. The report calls on Oregon lawmakers to repeal Measure 57. Hear the report on Prison Pipeline, March 20th at 6:30 p.m.
Andy Warhol looks at screen. Hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guests this week are Luzine Hill and Brenda Mallory. They have a show called Connecting Lines on at the Portland Art Museum now through October 29th. Thanks for coming into KBOO.
Thank you.
Thanks, Joseph.
This show is held in the Center for Contemporary Native Art. If people don't know that, that's the little room on the second floor that used to be the kids' center. Sorry, third floor. And this is a room dedicated to contemporary Native art. As you walk in, it's not a big space, but what are we going to see? What I saw was a silk shawl in red, like it looked like it was made of feathers, and then that was Luzine's work, and then Brenda's work was sculptures on the ground and up the walls, sort of steel wax. So Luzine, why don't you tell us what your piece is called?
My work is called Innate, which is a synonym for matriline. Early Native culture was matrilineal. The mother was very important. Females were very important. And this work is about empowering women, empowering Native women. It's also about the issue of violence against women, especially violence against Native women. And the cloak that is probably the first thing you'll see will be hanging up in the highest point of the gallery. It's an intimate gallery, and I think this work that we both are doing is intimate work. It's quiet and contemplative, but has energy.
Mm-hmm. And the cloak, it looks like a feather boa, but huge. You know, it covers the whole body. It's like 5 foot tall. Mm-hmm. It's red. The little individual leaves are made of, what are they made of?
The cloak is covered with 6,956 figures of a goddess from the early Ecuador coastal region. The 6,956 represents the average number of Native women assaulted in a year. They are clustered together in threes because Native people are victimized 3 times, 2.5 to 3 times more than other people in the United States. Early Cherokee people wore cloaks that were made of feathers. Feathers were attached to webbing. And that was kind of the beginning of this work. I'd seen one years ago. I wanted to use female figures. I also wanted to use cochineal as a dye. Works better on silk. There's another cloak that I wear under the large one that's made of organza. It is representing a continuing protective covering for me, for women. It's also has been dyed with a cochineal. The large cape hanging up is the first thing you'll see as you go toward into the gallery. On the next wall, the inner cape is attached to the wall as though it were in motion, and that I were just had left it.
Mm-hmm. Like you walked through the wall,
yes,
and left it behind.
Yeah, that I walked into the whiteness of the wall. And then there's a small alcove where all of the little cochineal bugs that I used to dye these two pieces, I kept, and they are displayed in some jars in an alcove. And then you go more to the right, and then Brenda's work is what you see.
So, Brenda, tell us a bit about what people will see.
My work is a series of standing forms that look a little bit like burned out ruins or left stalks after they've, cactus stalks after they've put off their blooms. And then on the walls and on the floor are these spore-like colorful pieces that go up the wall, and some are sitting on the floor. And this, my work is basically this. So Luzine and I are both of Cherokee heritage, and the Cherokees were removed from their homelands in 1838. So we are actually two separate nationally or federally recognized tribes, but basically we are, our heritage is from one tribe. So this piece I made as when we met at the Idlejorg Museum when we were both fellows there in contemporary Native art in 2016.
Where's that?
The Idlejorg Museum is in Indianapolis. And so this piece I actually showed there before, and it was in direct response to rereading some Cherokee history. The title of it is Recurring Chapters in the Book of Inevitable Outcomes, which is a long mouthful, but in these early books you just read these constant battles that the Cherokees had contact with Westerners, European discoverers, as early as the 1500s. So our group had contact so early that there's a lot of assimilation and
corruption of the culture.
Yeah, corruption of the culture early on. So anyway, but rereading this book, I just kept thinking, oh, I know where this is all going. I've read this history so many times before. So that's the genesis of the title. But I like to think of the ruin forms as this thing left behind, this beautiful what was, but it's not the end. And these spore-like forms, sort of seeds blowing through the air, represent, you know, something that continues. It's a new life. Maybe it doesn't look like the old one, but it's still there and vital.
And these are they're all about like a few feet tall, these pieces.
The standing forms, some of them are about 6 feet tall. And then the spore-like pieces are, I don't know, they range from maybe 36 inches across to 18 inches to 36 inches across.
And you used waxed fabric?
The frameworks are welded steel, and then the colorful part of it is, yes, waxed fabric, waxed with beeswax.
What's the significance of that?
The wax, it's an artistic medium. I've used it for years. I do think there's all this great significance to beeswax, though, this sort of the history of a bee's journey through a field and gathering pollen, and it's a natural material, and I like that juxtaposition of this natural material against the man-made steel, the hard and the soft.
Right. So you showed this piece before in the same kind of format?
Some slightly different arrangement, but actually this piece, its original genesis, I showed it at the a form of it at the Portland Airport. It was up for a year there, and I had been reading the book 1491, which is talks about the first forays of Westerners into the Americas, and
who's that by?
Do you remember his name?
I don't remember.
I'm spacing out on the name right now, but it basically talks about how the Americas were so changed, both in their plant materials, their animal life, and the indigenous people. It just decimated the cultures there, both through disease and colonization and repression. So I was doing this piece at the airport, and I think about how jet travel and air travel now makes all those influences happen so quickly. So it was sort of site-specific to the airport. And the spore-like pieces represent these things that just blow in and land and maybe take root. So those parts are still in this show at Portland Art Museum, but the standing ruins are different from what I showed there. So they're new, and I think they are very specific to this idea of rereading Cherokee history.
So, Luzine, your piece, you also did an action. So you did like a performance for video.
Yes.
So it was like a one-off thing that was captured so people can watch that on the museum website, pam.org?
Yes. We're still waiting for the video to be edited today.
Yeah.
It'll be displayed.
But the idea was, people come into the gallery and they'll see this cloak and they'll see the white piece against the wall, like you wear the cloak gets lifted off you, you're in this other piece below.
Yes.
And then you walk through the wall and leave that behind.
Yes.
People get a sense of that from just looking at the objects, or do they need the video?
I think the video was an integral part of the work. Video begins when I'm totally covered with a cloak in the alcove, and it resembles not a human. It resembles something that may be a plant or an animal. And then I start moving and gradually move out and across the gallery. And then at the very last, highest point in the gallery, I rise up and I turn, and then it's clearly a woman in a cloak. And shape-shifting is something, it's probably in other cultures, but it's a very big part of Native mythology, of being able to shape-shift from one form to another. And so that is why I wanted to do the action, that I'm shape-shifting material volume, which is a common device that I use in most of my installations, to have a visual impact of numbers. So that material volume is there, and it's not animated in the beginning of the action. I start moving and animating it, and then it becomes something else. It becomes an entity, and then it evolves into being an empowering and protection for Native women. And then it rises up. I walk out of it, but I'm still covered in a thin gossamer layer of cochineal and hued empowered power. Mm-hmm. And then I move and begin to feel that with my arms and my movements, and then move back toward almost where I started, but then I turn and move into this white infinity, and then I'm gone, but the power's there, and it's left for women.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to stay there. I mean, you know, the power is always going to be there. It's, you know, metaphorically.
One thing I think Luzine did forget to mention about the cochineal is that it's an acid that that only the females produce, and it's a protectant for them against predators.
Mm-hmm.
So the use of it in this protective mantle that she's made is significant.
What is the bug called, and how do you get the red dye out of it?
It's cochineal is the Spanish name for it, and there are lots of different native words for it, because each tribe used a different name. It's a small beetle scale kind of insect. It grows on a prickly pear cactus, which I think is interesting for Brenda's ruins work, that kind of suggests a cactus, so it's a nice reference. The bugs are scraped off the cactus. And they're very tiny. They're about the size of a peppercorn, or maybe smaller. They're dried in the sun, and then they are put in water, simmered, and you get a dye bath. And because they're made of, it's not a plant material, it's they are animals, wool and silk take them better. They take that intensity rather than a plant fabric, which is why I chose the silk to get that intense hue. But it was significant to Europe when the cochineal was taken back there, because prior to that point, Europeans only used things like madder, plant madder, M-A-D-D-E-R, which is kind of a muddy, dull brown, reddish brown. And so when the cochineal hit Europe, it was a sensation and very expensive.
And so it's kind of like chocolates or, you know,
spices at the same time. Yes,
everyone
yes, saffron.
It. Mm-hmm.
It's actually where the British redcoats got their dye, and the cardinals
in the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
Cardinal red.
Like the Roman emperors had their purple robes because the purple was so rare to get from the shell.
They
kind of saved it for best.
And, well, it represented power, it represented wealth. And then when the red came in, that surpassed it. And it was, the interesting thing is that the tiny bugs are hard to discern what they are after they've been dried. So for almost 100 years in Europe, the rest of the continent didn't know where exactly what they were or where they came from, until Leeuwenhoek invented the microscope and it became common. And then they could tell that it was a bug and not just a seed or something. And the Spanish held on to that little secret so that they could, you know, have a monopoly on the, and increase their wealth.
Mm-hmm.
My
name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guests this week are Luzine Hill and Brenda Mallory. Their show, Connecting Lines, is on at the Portland Art Museum now through October 29th. Brenda, you talked about reading the history of Native people. Are there any good histories written purely from the standpoint of the Natives, whether it's oral that was later written down or any written language that gives purely their perspective of being invaded?
I think one can't speak for all Native people. That's one thing to begin.
So you were talking about the Cherokee history.
Yeah, because we are a country of hundreds of federally recognized tribes in the U.S. alone. That's not even counting the South American indigenous peoples. There are so many histories of the Cherokee, I can't even name the one. The one I was reading was... actually antiquated James Mooney's history of the myth and
sacred formulas.
Yeah, so he was an early anthropologist who, I don't even know if they were called anthropologists at that point, but
what was his era?
Late 19th century. And he studied the Eastern Band Cherokee and spent time with them collecting their stories, their lore, their sacred plants. And but this book does recount a lot of the contact with Western people and their fights against to try to stay in their place. Yeah, the Cherokees were, and this happens all the time even to this day, trotting over the rights of indigenous people. As we know right now, at Standing Rock, it's happening, and in so many other places as well, but forcibly and illegally removed from their homelands in 1838 by Andrew Jackson's order over the Supreme Court. So, or he just didn't enforce the Supreme Court's order.
Mm-hmm. And that became the Trail of Tears?
Yes, that was
the... westward?
Yes, marched into Oklahoma, northeastern Oklahoma. Which is where the Cherokee Nation resides today, and it's actually, I think, the second largest Native population in the country.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, when you meet other Native artists in particular, do you feel an affinity, or is that just an outside kind of projection?
No, I think a lot of Native artists, we know our history, we know what that story is, we see how it's relevant even... in this day and time, maybe, I mean, you just look at power overcoming power taking what it wants. I mean, we look at Syrian refugees right now. Anytime you see, I think, a people that is being downtrodden or something taken from them, I think as a Native artist, you feel that maybe a little deeper because it's in your own history, mm-hmm. or in your own present in some cases.
So, Luzine, your work is about an incredibly depressing fact that Native American women are assaulted more than all the other races as a proportion.
Yes.
And usually by whom?
90% of the assaults, 90% or more of the assaults on Native women are by non-Native men. This is a unique ethnic kind of phenomenon, because in every other racial ethnic group, it's the same ethnicity for the man on the woman. But with Native women, it's non-Native men, mostly white, on Native women. The historical precedence for that is kind of astounding, but the most astounding thing is that it's still happening. It has a lot to do with that attitude that I think still persists of an historical Indian maiden. Mm-hmm. That's a very troubling.
Like just someone who's there for the taking.
Yes.
Right.
And that's what began with the first contact, and it continues now. There's the other aspect, which is a modern situation, is that the tribal land and jurisdiction for law enforcement on tribal land makes it possible for a non-Indian man to come onto the reservation and assault a woman and then leave, and the tribal police can't prosecute that person. It requires going to the FBI, and the FBI is busy with a lot of other things rather than individual women being assaulted. Mm-hmm. And they men know this, and it happens. And speaking of DAPL and the pipeline, besides the desecration of the environment that's happening, the camps of the people who are building the pipelines and working on the pipelines are primarily men together in camps for intense times, and their proximity to Indian reservations in the north, in the Middle West, and the upper Middle West,
and Canada,
creates these man camps, and they're right there, and they just, that increases the assaults on Native women, and it's so much violation on so many levels, mm-hmm. That it's sad. But my work is pointing that out, and it's provoking a dialogue about this, and it's, you know, visually getting your attention, but then empowering Native women and using our culture, our ancient culture with the cochineal and the goddess figures, and our matrilineal uniting to empower Native women and to know that you have this with you. You've been carrying all this, and you are a survivor, and you're a descendant of a survivor, and you are stronger than this. So that's what my piece is about.
Mm-hmm. Brenda, your piece is, what are the actual figures to represent? Are they trees, or is there any kind of literal structure that
I think there's not. I think there's not one literal structure. I feel like I myself see them in, I think they came to me from different resource searches. Like one thing, literally the, what are they called, chola cactus? I saw the gardens of those, and these little spikes that come off that are slightly dangerous. They almost jump on people to travel. But this thing left behind is this beautiful empty stalk. But at the same time, I've looked at burned out villages, and there were scorched earth policies back in the day when the Georgians were trying to make a state, and the settlers there, they would just burn out entire villages. So I feel like it's like, I always think the best abstract art is not one thing. You don't look at that and say, oh, it's burned out timbers. But maybe you do see a reference to a plant stalk that's let its seeds go, and now this is the skeletal remains.
Mm-hmm. So you're both dealing with kind of heavy stuff, and it's kind of tragic. How do you get away from, or do you even want to get away from, the whole idea that the only time white people or mainstream culture hears about natives, it's in a sort of pity sense, you know, something terrible happened to them, and that's the story. Both of you have added these kind of positive sides, the spores, the regrowth, and the protective qualities. How do you balance those things? Do you even consciously think about that?
I think Native Americans still are a very small minority in this country, and their stories aren't often told. But I certainly don't think of us as something to pity. I mean, the fact that we're still here and strong, many tribes are stronger than ever, I just think it talks so much about the power of people and their stories to unite and stay together. The Western nations often have very close ties to their original rights and tribal
traditions.
Like I, growing up in Oklahoma, actually feel like I have almost no real connection to the Cherokee tribal cultures. What I have is a close family culture, and in looking back on it in retrospect, I realize a lot of the things I just thought were things we did as a family really are sort of Cherokee cultures. But it was not something we talked about. We were just Oklahomans, you know. So, but it's a funny thing. I think it's a both sad that our cultures were matrilineal, but Luzine and I both trace our legal culture and our legal heritage through our father's lines. So the patriarchy that, you know, the Cherokees, what was it called? Petticoat government, when the early U.S. government would deal with the Cherokee tribes, there were always women involved, and so they called it like a petticoat government. But women were super important, and but over periods of time, that type government was not allowed to happen. It wouldn't be taken seriously, I guess.
And also, the Cherokee tribe in the early 19th century tried very hard to assimilate in order to survive. And I do want to say that when the Cherokees were removed from the East in 1838, they were not living in little, definitely not teepees, that was Western, but they weren't living in their, in just little houses or little hogans or anything like that. They were living in two-story houses and had large plantation kind of homesteads. We had a bilingual newspaper called the Cherokee Phoenix, and when Sequoia created our written language, within 6 months, 90% of the Cherokee people were literate, when the rest of the population surrounding them, literacy was probably 40%. So the people that were shoved off and removed from their homes in 1838 in North Georgia and North Carolina were not hunter-gatherers who didn't have a culture. They were on a high very level of civilization in comparison to the surrounding people.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guests this week were Luzine Hill and Brenda Mallory. Their show Connecting Lines is on now at the Portland Art Museum in the Center for Contemporary Native Art through October 29th. Thanks very much for coming into KBOO.
Thank you.
Thanks, Joseph.
Andy Warhol looks a scream. Hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
Good afternoon, almost. You are listening to KBOO Portland, and it's coming up top of the hour at noon. Coming up next, after these announcements, is Buscando America. Buscando America has been made possible by KBOO members and a grant from Portland 5, presenting Lila Downs, the indigenous singer-songwriter whose lyrics focus on social justice and often tell the stories of workers who migrate from Mexico to the U.S. Lila Downs performs Sunday, April 2nd, at the Newmark Theater. Tickets and info for this all-ages evening with Lila Downs available at portland5.com.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, Dark Circle, is showing Thursday, March 16th at 7 p.m. Dark Circle is a documentary film that focuses on the connections between the nuclear weapons and the nuclear power industries. Again, that's Dark Circle, Thursday, March 16th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.